obviously we're talking about Oppenheimer today, but I was thinking about, what if there was a music producer named Boppenheimer who made bops that almost destroyed the world because they were so fire? Is that something you guys think could happen? Or
I just wanted to see how long that would go. I hate to interrupt, but welcome to Hate to Interrupt. I am Ethan from youtube.com/Gulif, and I'm joined by
Nick from Stop Culture.
Nick from VHS guy, Nick.
Yes. So today we're going to be talking about the 2023 Christopher Nolan film, Oppenheimer, which...
Sloppenheimer.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. Nick fucking hates this movie for reasons I can't comprehend. But yeah, it feels like we might be a little bit late to this conversation because Oppenheimer was like the talk of the town 2 years ago, the Barbenheimer thing, but we're getting into it today. So if anyone is interested in that, hopefully we can turn the clock back and get into Oppenheimer a little bit. But also...
Wait, what? Yeah. Did you guys do the Barbenheimer thing? Did you see them both in the same day?
I did.
Same weekend?
I didn't see them the same. I saw them the same weekend, not the same day.
Okay. I saw them the same day.
Because I only saw Barbie.
I loved Barbie much more than Oppenheimer.
I saw Barbie. No, Oppenheimer first, and then Barbie, which I feel like is the way to do it. You know.
Because, a palate cleanser after the heavy shit.
Yeah. Oppenheimer's really heavy, and Barbie is... I mean, Barbie's kind of heavy, too, though. So it gets heavy
a little towards bit, the yeah. end,
but it's mostly fun.
It's fun.
So, yeah, I think that was the better way to do the Barbenheimer thing. But then also, we're going to talk about the first episode of The Last of Us that aired last night. And then to end things out, we're going to get into iDubbbz and him bringing back Content Cop and just kind of like the transformation of his channel, which is has been like a hot debate on in YouTube circles for the past couple of years. So yeah, let's get into Oppenheimer first, though.
Let's get into Oppenheimer. So Mr. Culture Nick, tell us the whole legacy of you and Nick having this goddamn battle over Oppenheimer for the entire history of the pod.
Yeah. So I was the one who recommended Oppenheimer. I mean, you know, partially I recommended it because I know me and Nick were, you know, we differ pretty greatly on our opinion of the movie. I feel like since the very first episode of this podcast, I think it was brought up on that episode. And ever since then, like every five episodes it comes up with, and we both
we mentioned it a lot.
We get into like sort of a debate on it, but like we haven't really been able to get into it because every time it's brought up, like, you know, I haven't seen it right away, and it's a very dense movie. So you can't necessarily like argue for or against it without having seen it recently because, you know, there's just so much to unpack with it. So I figured, you know, we could recommend it for that reason. But also, I mean, it's one of my favorite movies of 2020 so far. I think it's Christopher Nolan's best film by far. I think it's a pretty extraordinary movie. I think it tackles so many different ideas. I was saying in the group chat before, it's a movie about one of the most interesting people in history and digging into one of the most interesting times in history, you know, the backdrop of World War II, creation of the atomic bomb. Like, there's just so much to unpack with this movie. I think the themes are really dense. I think it's beautiful visually and has one of the best casts I've seen in modern history too. So, I mean, that's kind of why I recommended it and why I love it.
And the opposing view?
I don't want to exaggerate, so I'm going to tone down my critique a little bit.
This is the worst fucking movie I've ever seen.
It's the most boring movie I've ever seen in my life. It's not the worst. It's fine. But, like I was restarting watching this movie today, and I was watching it on my computer, and, like, the urge to open up my second screen and watch shit on YouTube the entire time was, like, the most powerful urge I've ever felt in my life. So I literally had to go lay down in my bed and watch it there. Otherwise, there's no way I could have paid attention to this movie. I think watching it originally in IMAX is, like, the only reason I was able to, like, actually sit through it and, like, somewhat enjoy it. But sitting at home watching this movie is fucking pain.
Did you like it more when you saw it? I mean, you just said you can at least watch it, but did you enjoy it at all in the theater, seeing it in IMAX?
I could enjoy the spectacle of it a little bit more in, like, an IMAX setting for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing I will say. Like, seeing it in IMAX, the first time I saw it, I was like, whoa. I actually thought it was one of the best movies I've ever seen. And watching it at home, I don't necessarily feel that way anymore. But I remember just loving it so, so much in the theater. And my appreciation of it, like, kind of depreciated watching it at home. So I know where you're coming from. But calling this movie boring is, like, literally insane to me. I don't know how it could be boring. It's dense, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of ground to cover plot-wise and thematically, but it's so fast-paced. I mean, there's like a cutthroat pace and style of editing that kind of keeps you engaged, or keeps me engaged the whole time.
I don't even think it's the editing or necessarily, I mean, it's partially part of the editing. A lot of it's just like the music. Like, I think the score is what saves the movie.
Yeah, score is really good.
But that's one of those things. Like, most people say that the score in movies like this, or in, especially in Tenet, that was like a big criticism of that movie, that Nolan movie, where the music is so loud and it's like blaring in your ears the entire time. But it's also like a very exposition heavy film, or, you know, just very dense narratively.
Well, I think the music just very perfectly fit the tone and was very, I think the like very amped up, like fast-paced music kind of made those tense moments feel tense like they're supposed to, as opposed to the actual dialogue itself making it tense.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ethan's been hiding his opinion from us this whole time. I'm curious what you thought of the movie.
I'm sorry, Nick, but to which one? Who knows? I like this movie. I'm sorry, VHS guy. I really like this movie. I don't watch a lot of biopics, but the subject matter is so inherently intriguing and such a fascinating main character to have that I could have watched a 4-hour cut of this. I was super hooked into this.
Yeah.
I loved every second of this. And I don't get that. We had an earlier discussion a few episodes ago and you were like, just don't get how Cillian Murphy's like a big actor. You know, he's just not like that. He's not that crazy. He was so fucking good in this. I get why he won the award.
He was good, but he didn't blow me away. Like,
there was he blew up a bomb and blew me away, bro. Come on.
He literally
And the bomb scene away. Itself, it could have been so good. Yeah, we can so get to good.
That. I will the say bomb, the bomb like, scene was kind of... The only thing holding it back good. Was the effect was bad.
It was bad. It was like... That's like what it's been building up to this entire fucking 2 hours... And then the bomb just looks like absolute dog shit.
I mean, I don't know. I don't. I guess the bomb could have looked better. Maybe if no one was willing.
It
to
just didn't look like a
CGI.
Nuke to me.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, you have to say like the build up to it, the fucking music.
Oh yeah,
the tension, the tension to actually seeing the bomb. Like, yeah, sure, the explosion might have been like a bit lackluster. I almost didn't even really care though. Because I actually really preferred just seeing like the blinding white light on all of their faces instead of actually seeing the bomb.
I feel like it just left out the explosion altogether.
That's what I was gonna say. I feel like it would have been more effective, honestly, if they just entirely cut out the practical explosion and just show this white blast of light, and then everyone's just like, "Holy shit, what have we done?"
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, do you think
see it and you can? You see the bomb go off and you see, like, I can watch the way the flames are moving and I'm like, that's like 100 feet, maybe.
Gasoline fire.
Do you think it would have been better if Nolan wasn't so anti-CGI?
I wish he just set off an actual nuke in the Nevada.
That's hilarious.
I think that I like that he is opposed to it, but I don't think he should be so like... so opposed to it, you know.
Yeah,
I like his use of practical a lot of the time, like in Interstellar, which I'm not a huge Interstellar fan either, but I think all his like practical effects in that movie look amazing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff that he had to do CGI with. Could you imagine if he tried to do the wave sequence from Interstellar practically?
True.
Whoa, these 20-foot waves are crazy.
There's just
dude.
A time and place, and I just feel like, especially with how much hype they built up about that movie, because they really hyped up that bomb scene in the marketing, and it just was very underwhelming.
I don't think it's underwhelming. I mean, I think, yeah, sure, the explosion could have looked better, but beyond that, I mean, I think it was done. It was one of the most tense sequences I've seen in a movie theater. And it's not like there's really the stakes of it, if you think about it, are like, will it go off or won't it go off? It's not like anyone's about to die. It's not like anything actually like dangerous is happening. I mean, it's dangerous because they do think there's like a small non-zero, as they say in the movie, percent chance of like destroying the entire world. But I'm saying like the stakes aren't like, you know, I've seen really tense sequences of movies where there's like somebody's life on the line. But this scene was really well done, despite there not being like an actual life or death component to it. You know what I mean?
It was like watching it, because like the entire world in a way was watching them while not knowing it was happening.
Yeah.
You know, like they're like everything. Once we do this and once we know we can do this, the world is going to entirely change forever.
Yeah.
We have opened Pandora's box.
I think most people who have a critique for that scene, and me included, are not necessarily bashing the actual editing or performances or anything on that portion of the scene. It's just whenever the marketing is like, we're going to fucking make the most cool explosion ever, Nolan is doing it all practically. And when you hear all that kind of stuff and you see that, it's just like, why? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I think even beyond the explosion, the Trinity sequence is still probably the best scene in the movie. I mean, you know, every other sequence, it's kind of like the only action sequence, if you could call it that. So every other sequence is just, you know, old guys or old white guys talking in rooms or whatever, which is another criticism in this movie that I don't personally share, but I'm just saying.
I think my favorite scene probably was after the explosion, like the scene building up to right whenever he gets his clearance revoked.
Mm-hmm.
I think whenever they're really just laying into him and just like he's like kind of breaking down, I think that was the best scene in the movie.
When the white light's coming on him again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
Well, actually, no, my favorite scene in the movie is right after they actually drop the bomb on, I guess it's after Nagasaki. I'm not sure if it's Hiroshima or Nagasaki, but when they're all stomping their feet on the bleachers and then he starts seeing that white light again, and then some of them are like have their fucking skin flapped off and everything. Like, that was really, really a powerful scene. And you see how he's sort of grappling with like, should I adopt that father of the bomb persona, and being like, when he's like, you know, using that kind of like jingoistic talk of like, oh, like I wish we just had it in time to use it on Germany. And you know, you could see everyone's applauding, but no one's really, there's no sound because he's not actually feeling that emotion. You know, I thought the editing of that scene was really, really brilliant in like showcasing how conflicted he actually was once the bomb was really used. And also just seeing all the other people in the room that they had so many conflicting emotions too. There was like people, you know, celebrating and hooking up, and then there was people crying, and it's kind of a disturbing scene, just like watching that, those two, like the two polarities of the emotional response to actually dropping the bomb, like the culmination of their work, you know. I really love that scene.
I just wish like I'm not saying they necessarily had to show like the bombs dropping in Japan and shit, but when you have a movie that's so dense and dialogue heavy like this, like I feel like there has to be some kind of like release for the people watching. Like, I feel like there's no moment where I was just like, oh, thank God, we're finally getting something. I mean, maybe the bomb explosion, but like, for me, it was underwhelming. Like, if you think about something like JFK, have y'all seen Oliver Stone's JFK?
Yeah.
No.
Well, like I feel like whenever you actually get to like the meat of that movie, you're like, oh fuck, this fucking 4-hour movie is worth it. Yeah, worth it now. I just never feel like I got that moment with this movie.
But it's also kind of one of those stories that doesn't have any kind of satisfying end. It does.
They literally drop two fucking nuclear bombs on
Japan. No, it has a satisfying end, but the whole point is this is following a character that has to deal with the ramifications and morality of being the creator of such a catastrophic weapon that can take so much life. So there's not going to be any like easy conclusion for the main character.
But
it doesn't have to be.
But also showing that would also give us more insight into his brain about what terrible acts he's done and how he's feeling, you know?
I kind of like that they don't show it. Like, I mean, we're experiencing it in the same way he experiences it. Like, just hears about it. They go, well, it hit Hiroshima.
Yeah.
You know, that's all you would have got back then.
Maybe the separation is intentional. I don't know.
I mean, they show you the ramifications of it in that scene I was just talking about, where he's seeing the, you know, people with their fucking skin melting off and flapping off and everything. Like, that's kind of the most you see of what the atomic bomb actually does to someone viscerally, which kind of, I think, is all you need, because like Ethan said, like, we're supposed to be experiencing this point in history in this guy's life from his point of view, more or less. So I think doing it that way, I mean, it's also just like, it's not, it is about, you know, dropping the bomb, but I think it's more about like the creation of the bomb, him as a person, and what happened to him in the aftermath, than it actually is about the day those bombs dropped. You know?
I get that. I'm more so talking about not what's best for this movie, but what's best for the cinematic experience for the people watching it. And I think having something that's actually exciting in the movie would make it a more entertaining movie.
I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of it is extremely exciting. I mean, it's exciting in a different way than seeing the actual explosion or whatever. But I think it's very fast paced. The stakes are all emotional and they're very high the entire time. It never really lets up.
It's also the same pace the entire time too. It's like there's no slowdown. There's no speed up. It's like all the same pace throughout the entire movie, which I don't know if I like that either.
Yeah, but I mean, there's just so much to get through. I mean, it covers about like a 15-year period, I'm pretty sure. Like, it seems to start in, well, no, I mean, it starts way before that, but there's only a little bit that you get of him in college. So I guess it's like more of like a 20, 25-year period. And just within that period of time, like within Oppenheimer's life and just within American history and world history, like, there's just so much to cover. I don't really know if there is that much time to slow down. I mean, clearly not. It's like a 3-hour movie and the pace is breakneck the entire time, basically. So, I mean, the only time it really slows down is the last scene, when you get that like very contemplative conversation between Einstein and Oppenheimer.
That's another problem I had. Einstein isn't near autistic enough in this movie.
Is he supposed to be more? I don't really know that much about Einstein. Was that how he was?
Super weird and autistic, yeah. And this movie is like normal as fuck.
It's I was actually going to mention this. This felt like a movie where the wrong crowd would go see it, and there'd be references like someone voted against you, Strauss. Who was the person? Someone named John F. Kennedy, and the crowd goes, yeah, JFK. And then like they're like, I've got to go see Albert. And then it cuts to Albert.
Honestly, that probably happened if you go see it with like a room full of boomers.
Probably. They're like, oh, I love Einstein.
Yeah.
I know him.
No, I mean, I don't know, man. I think just like the main reasons why I love this movie is like the themes. I mean, I wrote like a little bit about this for a publication that I was working on a couple years ago. But like, to me, I see it as like the three core themes of Oppenheimer that I find really interesting. It's like, one, it's about the inextricable link between scientific advancement and destruction. Also, the third act of the movie is kind of about how inevitably, so often, not even just like scientific figures or political figures, just like any public figure, entertainment figures even, like eventually there comes a time where people who reach that level of greatness have their downfall and the public sort of revels in it, like the martyrdom of public heroes. And then also, what was the last one? I wrote it down here. The civic responsibility of genius, which is kind of Oppenheimer's main struggle throughout the entire time. Like, should I use my genius to, you know, in this field that not that many scientists know about, to create this bomb, despite the fact that, you know, the theoretical physics he's working on, I think there's the Robbie character. He says in the beginning of like the Los Alamos sequence, like, I don't want the culmination of 3 centuries of physics to end with a weapon of mass destruction. Like, that's kind of Oppenheimer's struggle throughout the whole movie. And I don't know, I find all of that stuff like really, really interesting. And I think the film explores all of that stuff really, really deftly. I just really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I won't take any of that away from you. I think honestly, maybe this isn't my type of movie. I don't know if I have the attention span for it. Like, I can't do it. I'll never watch it again. It was painful.
as someone who hasn't watched a lot of biopics, how does this what would you guys consider like the greats of biopics out there in like film?
This is by far my favorite biopic for sure.
Open really? Okay.
Yeah.
I like The Disaster Artist.
Because I mean, I
Walk the Line.
Yeah, that's a good one too. But you know, because like you were saying, Ethan, like I don't really like biopics usually, and I think a lot of the criticisms that we've been hearing from a lot of people recently about like, A Complete Unknown, for example, a lot of people have been referring to these movies as Wikipedia article movies, or that. But also, the main criticism I hear is like it was a Wikipedia article in cinematic form, which I think saying about that about this movie is just extremely reductive and just not fair to the Nolan and everyone who worked on it.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
I don't
say
think
that
that's
at all.
Fair about this, but I also don't. That's not my criticism with biopics. I think my biggest issue with biopics is like a lot of the time they very much romanticize the people, and I feel like this movie did suffer from that. Where it definitely felt like Christopher Nolan had like the biggest hard on for Oppenheimer in the world.
I mean, it like I understand what you're saying, but also like the world idolizes him, and it's him grappling with. I mean, you're going to be associated as the guy, the father of the atom bomb, which he the whole time he's grappling with what that means and if he even wants that, and also like why that's a bad
thing.
But it
didn't
even
really
show like he's great
grappling with it. Like it showed him having like weird visions and stuff, but it never showed like him truly like emotional about any of the damage he caused.
What are you talking about? Yeah.
There were multiple scenes. Truman had to tell him to get out of his office and hand him a handkerchief, which I actually had to look up. There's no evidence of the handkerchief, Truman actually handing it to him, but he did call him a crybaby and said, "Don't ever let him back in my office again." That actually happened.
Don't let that crybaby back in here.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I don't know, the very last scene when he's like, "I came to you, Albert, a while ago to see if we could, my work at Los Alamos, if it could start a chain reaction that would destroy the world." And he's like, "I think we did." And he's like, the look on his face is like, "Fuck, I just ruined everything," you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, yeah. I don't think it's like, I don't think the movie necessarily idolizes him because it shows him in kind of a negative light in certain ways, especially in terms of like his political naivety, I think is one of the main ways that it sort of shows you that like he's not as adept at handling all this stuff as really you would assume for someone of his stature. Like he has that whole thing with Chevalier. He has he gets entangled up with Casey Affleck's character, who's like a rabid anti-communist. Meanwhile, he's like, he has communist ties in his past. I mean, I think it's not really supposed to be showing him as this great man. I think it's more of just like showing how important and integral he was to history, and also what happened to him after for just serving his country in the way that he felt was the way he could serve it at that time. You know, so I don't know. It could go. I could see what you mean, but
I planned on watching this movie and like writing a bunch of notes and then like coming in like ready to like just start naming off reasons I hate this movie. But like I got like halfway through the movie and I was just like, I don't think I have the ability to do this. Like I was just bored. Like that's it. Like that's my main criticism. I have like random things I don't like about it, but really it's just it just did not hold my attention, and I don't even know if I can place a finger on the why.
I'm just picturing you watching this movie while you're watching Family Guy clips on your phone.
Dude, I'd have rather be watching Family Guy clips for 3 hours.
Well, one thing that you said that I wanted to dig into a little bit was like you said that you think Oppenheimer is objectively bad, which I don't know. I mean, he did create a bomb that killed millions and millions of, or not millions of people. I think it was like 200,000 people around. Yeah.
People.
I mean, he put the fear of God into everyone for the rest of time. That's kind of like the main thing that he'll be remembered for. The way he calls it, like a raw display of divine power or whatever. But I don't know. Just saying he's objectively bad, I don't think is necessarily the case, because the context of why he had to jump into that project and why he felt like he needed to be there was the Nazis were going to make the bomb. I think the movie does a really good job of illustrating that.
But
so
the Nazis
like,
were already pretty much defeated by the time that the bomb was made.
Not by the time they started, though. They were way behind the Nazis. If they didn't start at Los Alamos.
Yeah, but he didn't have to continue.
I think, well, but also, the film also Japan has an answer for that too. Like they, when he was, when all of the, you know, when Hitler was already dead and Oppenheimer sees that, like all of his underlings more or less are having that meeting about like, should we do this or not? He has a pretty good reason. It's like, people aren't going to understand what this is until it's used. And once it is used, it will usher in an era of peace that mankind has never known before. And he was right about all of that, you know, because we haven't had a World War III since then. And I don't, it's much more unlikely because nukes are involved now, you know. I think that's a pretty good point.
I think just because you can doesn't mean you should, man. I understand that the outcome is probably a positive, but just being somebody who's able to do that, I think makes you somewhat of an innately bad person.
But at the same time,
I couldn't do it.
The work was already to a point where even if every single theoretical physicist or all whatever, you know, all the different fields of science that all those people in that room were engaged in to create the bomb, even if they all went on strike or something, the project was at a point where they could have hired more people, could have found other people to finish the project, and it's out of their hands at that point, you know? Like, they did start the project to fight against the Nazis and everything, but at that point, it was going to happen whether Oppenheimer was involved or not, or any of them, you know?
It was just a matter of time, yeah, even if it got stopped.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't picture somebody who would make something like that in a good light. It's just kind of how it is, and that's just a personal thing, I guess.
But it's, I mean, the Japanese, they really weren't going to surrender. I mean, their philosophy, their psychology is of the kamikaze fighter. Like, that's why they were the only power in World War II who had people like that would just fucking fly their planes into opposing, you know, fighters and air fighters and dogfights or military facilities or whatever. They were going to kill themselves before they surrendered in this war. And it's like, it's just one of those big questions in history. Like, what would have caused less suffering? A ground invasion of Japan or dropping the bombs? I mean, it's,
I think the right thing was done. I just think the people that are willing to do it are bad people.
So who's worse though? Truman, who dropped it, or Oppenheimer, who made it?
I mean, obviously Truman.
Yeah. So, I mean, Oppenheimer was just the guy. He was just the man of the moment. I mean, the movie makes it kind of seem like he was the only person who could have done this, but I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, there was a lot of scientists who
I think there's a lot of people that probably could have done it. I think to have your hands in something like that, just you kind of have to be a special kind of fucked up, you know?
Yeah.
Or you have to disassociate yourself.
I'm not saying enough. I think we need people like that are willing to do things like that. I'm just not one of them, and I can't look up to those people.
Oppenheimer, I mean, he did spend the rest of his career as much as he could until his security clearance was revoked, like trying to lobby for policies that would try to denuclearize not just the US, but just the entire global landscape. Like, he did try to use his public profile and his scientific expertise and his place in history and how much people respected him at that time to try to kind of quell some of those tensions. So I think that's, you know, that counts for something as well. You know, you have to take that into account when like making the
measure. He was like, in a way, making amends for his past actions.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I get it. And I don't know. I definitely feel like the movie, like just like the angle the movie takes does glorify him a bit too much. But at the same time, I mean, that's kind of just the way of the biopic. Like, that's like every fucking biopic. So,
I mean, what do you think about the last, cause I think if we're going to be trying to determine like what's the most boring or kind of like the part of the movie that drones on, like I would imagine that criticism is probably levied against the third act more than anything, when it's like all political, it's all the shit with RDJ.
That was the more interesting part for me. I think the first everything after the actual bomb goes off was much more interesting for me.
And I think everything before like Los Alamos like is pretty slow. It takes a while to kind of build momentum to me.
Yeah,
like that was when I actually started being able to pay attention a little better, is like once they started getting to the fast paced like board hearings and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I don't know, I didn't feel that way at any point. I remember distinctly like remembering when I've watched this in theaters, I felt like I'm definitely gonna have to like watch this again or do some research on this to like fully grasp every little thing that's happening. Like you get the main gist of it. Like, you know that Strauss set into motion some kind of political machinations that ended up having Oppenheimer in this room with these like sort of very rabidly anti-communist McCarthyist, like, you know, this panel of people that are there to revoke his security clearance, but like all the little backdoor dealings, wheelings and dealings that resulted in that, like, I'm going to have to watch this again because it's so fast paced. So like, I understand that criticism of it, that there's just so much information.
I'm sure both of you don't necessarily agree with me on this, but it's something that I've had a hard time like thinking about, and maybe I need to make a video about it so I can actually like kind of put my thoughts into something readable. But there's something about most of Nolan's movies that on rewatch, they just get worse for me. And I don't know what it is, but there's like probably two of his movies that I can actually sit down and rewatch. But most of them, every time I watch them, I like them less and less. And I just, do y'all feel that same way about any of his movies?
I felt that way for Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, I mean, I think Nolan's movies really, really shine in theaters more than usual. I mean, that's kind of a truism that you can stick on most really good directors or even just most movies. But like, he really does. I mean, he tells people to go watch his movies on the biggest screen possible because they really shine on the biggest screen possible. So I get that. Like the fucking speakers, the loud music, everything. Like, it really, really feels great to watch a movie like this in theaters. I think it's more that, just the experience, like the visceral experience of sitting in the theater where a movie like this is mostly just people talking in rooms, but it still feels like it's bombarding you with not just like information, but just like stimulus, you know? It's so much.
But if you think about something like Interstellar, right? Which is just the performances in that, like Matthew McConaughey just like is incredible on screen in that movie. He's so absolutely good in that movie. But for some reason, it's just I like that movie less and less every time I watch it, regardless of like great performances, great special effects. Like, I just don't know what it is about his movies that I don't know. Like, I don't feel like I should have to watch that movie in theaters to enjoy it.
Yeah, but don't you? I mean, you probably enjoy every movie more in theaters, don't you? I mean, I feel like everybody does.
No, but like, there's a difference between enjoying something more in theaters versus like walking out of a movie being like, that movie was fucking amazing, and then watching it again 6 months later at home and being like, I didn't even like that.
Oh, well, I mentioned that my appreciation of it like was sort of devalued after watching it at home, but it wasn't from going from like, holy shit, that was an amazing movie, which actually was my reaction coming out of theater, to I didn't even like that. It was more like, I thought this was one of the best movies I've ever seen. Now watching it again at home, I'm not sure of that. Like, I wouldn't put Oppenheimer in my top 10, but it's definitely in my top 20. I'll say that.
Okay. It's like, it's always, I always find myself doing this. When I come out of a movie and I enjoyed it, I always have to temper my expectations of how it's going to rest in my mind and my heart. I like whenever I go see a movie, especially in theaters, because you have so much like excitement around you, and just watching a movie in a movie theater makes it so much better. But I'll like wait a few days, and because like initial ratings, if it's something I liked, it's usually higher than it actually ends up being. That's kind of just the way it goes for me.
Yeah,
I have a post shit score and an out of theater score. So I'll score it immediately out of the theater, and then after I've taken my next shit after seeing the movie, that's whenever my like official score is in place.
Got it.
So however long that is, sometimes it's like sometimes like the next day, sometimes it's that night.
I thought you were going to say sometimes it's in the next few days.
That usually locks it in though.
I mean, that's like Jeremy Johns' rating system. Like, I won't remember this in T-2 days. Yours is like T-2 shits. Which is
it'll be gone. It'll be flushed out of my system into my toilet.
Yeah, but just, like piggybacking off what you're talking about with like a larger Nolan conversation, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you guys, but like after I saw Tenet, I was just about to give up on Christopher Nolan. Like, I was like, I don't know if I can fuck with this guy's movies at all anymore. And then I saw Oppenheimer and I was like, I can't wait to see whatever this guy does next. even though I'm mixed on his filmography as a whole, but I think he's really hitting a stride right now. If Oppenheimer is any indication, like, I think he's hitting the peak of his career now.
I think it really helps for you, though, that this movie is, like, very, very much down your alley.
Yeah, that's true.
Which I can't take that away from you. Like, if you can, like, really relate to it or, like, find themes in it that you can, like, find yourself in, then more power to you for, like, loving it for that reason. I just don't think I have that those same, like, connections to the movie.
Yeah. Well, what's he was working? It seems like he's working on an adaptation of the Odyssey, right? Is that what he's
doing? Yeah, he's making a full-on fantasy epic.
Yeah, which, how are you going to do that without CGI? But
he said he's apparently considering using, like stop-motion stuff as well. I read somewhere that he's doing something similar to that. Or, like, building big animatronics and stuff. Because that's The Odyssey, you got, like, Cyclops and stuff in there. Like, you can't just practical effects. Well, we're going to go get a Cyclops, hire a Cyclops, you know, off the island. And
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see how he's going to do all that.
I mean, I don't know.
I'm excited to see it, but I don't think I'm going to like it.
It's kind of like Oppenheimer, you can't put the genie back in the bottle with this nuclear advancement stuff. Like, Nolan should fucking take a page out of that book. Like, we can't go back and say that CGI can't be used in movies anymore. Like you guys are talking about with, I didn't really feel that way about the Trinity test or whatever, but, like, it would have been better, sure, if you would have just top CGI house or whatever the fuck they're called, make a great nuclear mushroom cloud for the Trinity test. You know, like, why not just do that? I feel like it's kind of is this weird, like, anti-futurist tech position that I don't really get his position on.
Well, it's the same. I mean, he refuses to not shoot on film too, which, to be fair, film looks better, but, like,
wait, sure, he refuses to shoot on film or refuses to not shoot on film. Or to shoot on digital? Okay.
He refuses to shoot on digital, which, fine, film looks better, but, like, I'm sure there's moments where digital would work probably better than film.
And be cheaper.
Yeah.
A lot cheaper. Yeah, but it's interesting to me because it's like, I can always appreciate practical effects, but there's often a limit where I'm like, okay, guys, this does not need to be practical. Like, I can't think of any examples right now, but there has gotten to points where, I mean, everything we see nowadays, especially, like, superhero genre, half of that stuff isn't practical, and half of that stuff can't be practical. We can't be practical for everything, but I will point out when it's practical effects, and they're great. I'm always down for some really good practical effects, especially, like, throwback movies. I love those where they just lean into the puppetry and stuff, but there was an interesting point when he was making Tenet. Do you guys remember the sequence where he crashes an airplane into an airport?
Yeah.
I don't remember. They,
okay, there's a part where they, like, have to crash. I don't fucking remember anything about that movie. But there's a part where they crash a plane into an airport, and they, like, basically did the math. They were originally going to do it CG, and they're like, it will actually be cheaper if we just crash an actual plane into an airport, because we can buy the building, and we can buy the plane, and that's cheaper than paying a CGI team, which I think is very funny.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. I feel like it's this weird kind of position that he's taking just to kind of, it seems like he's just doing it for, like, an aesthetic or, like, dick measuring kind of way of being like, oh, I'm not one of these superhero, you know, I'm not part of the MCU, you know, I'm not of that mindset or whatever. Like, this weird kind of way to separate himself from modern filmmaking, the things we all kind of despise about modern filmmaking. But it's like, there's a fucking line, dude. Like, you gotta hop on board to some degree, you know. Although I will say the way practical effects were used to kind of illustrate Oppenheimer's visions of this the hidden universe that he talks about, that was really cool too. I don't even know how that was done. Do you guys know how he did that kind of stuff? Like, the, you know, I'm talking about the visions. What's in the beginning.
There's a guy who did it, who goes into it. William, what's his, do you know the guy's channel? William something. He's like a amateur filmmaker.
No.
Mm-mm.
Where he, like, recreates scenes from movies.
Oh, okay. I've heard of this guy.
Yeah. I think it's like William H. Baker or something. Look up his videos on it, and he does a pretty good job of showing how they did it in Oppenheimer, and then he does, like, his own version of it and tries to reproduce it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, we got other stuff to talk about, so we should probably wrap up the Oppenheimer conversation. I just want to, yeah,
I do.
I'm just glad we talked about it, and I feel like it's, you know, I love it. I'm sorry Nick doesn't like it. I'm sorry to make you watch it, but I'm glad we talked about it. That's my feeling.
Well, I'm glad to have seen it for the first time, because I've been, you know, pretending to be a part of this whole Barbenheimer discussion when I hadn't seen the same day sequel. So I'm glad I got to see it. There actually is one thing I was trying to mention. I just forgot to jump in. Was when we were talking about the editing, it feels like this was Christopher Nolan's first attempt at like art house style editing, with like him talking to the audience and like the like half of the audience is dying. The claps are all silent. I was like, oh, that was very effective. One thing I didn't think was effective and came off as more comical was where he's in the he's got all those people doing the like what's it called? Whatever the trial he's on in that small room. And then he's just having sex with Florence Pugh at the table while they're all just talking to him. I was like, all right, like I get what you're going for, but this is like very comical to me.
And no, that was beautiful. That was absolutely beautiful.
I know why you think it's beautiful.
Just because you love Florence Pugh, bro.
I will not accept criticism of that scene. It was gorgeous. So you want to do
ratings?
Yeah, let's do ratings. I'll go 9 out of 10. On Oppenheimer.
What's stopping it from a 10, sir?
I don't know. It would take.
Is it the rewatch put doubt in your mind?
That's more of what it was. If I was able to rewatch Oppenheimer in an IMAX theater every time I wanted to see it, it would be a 10 out of 10. But I can't do that, so.
5.5.
Damn. So you liked it more than you hated it.
Yeah, it's not a bad movie. It's just not my bag.
I'm giving this one a solid, strong, firm 8 out of 10.
Nice. And I just want to thank you for watching it, Nick. I mean, I know it's a long ass movie. I appreciate it. I know you don't like it, so it's great that you did watch it for the podcast.
I don't even sit down and hate the movie. I just like it's just really hard for me to pay attention to it. That's really all it is.
Yeah, I feel you. So all right, let's get into what were you gonna say, Ethan?
Oh, I didn't watch the Oscars that year. This won like everything, right? At the Oscars?
It was a sweep, yeah. It won most of the big awards, yeah. I don't know off the top of my head how many, but
I think it was Best Actor, and then RDJ won Best Supporting, and then they won Best Picture. That's all I remember. Maybe
I'm pretty sure Nolan won Best Director too.
Got it.
So yeah, let's get into The Last of Us, yeah.
Did you guys hear they announced a prequel for The Last of Us? It's called A Bunch of Us. Sorry. Anyway.
That's funny. That was funny. Dude, you should have started with that rather than Boppenheimer. That was funny.
I forgot
can
about
we,
that. I heard
can
that
we just go through and like... I feel like it might help if we just kind of give maybe a rating for what we thought of the first season so we can see where we're all like going into this.
Yeah, because you're a fucking hater. Yeah. I really like the first season. I think I'm an 8 out of 10. Either a 7 or an 8. It's in between there somewhere. I really like it, and I've played the games. I think some of the changes worked. Some of the changes don't work, but overall, I think it's a pretty phenomenal adaptation, and yeah, I'm happy with it.
I'll go with 8 out of 10, maybe 8.5, probably just 8, but yeah, I really, really love the first season.
I'm at like a 6 on it, and... But, okay, so I don't like Bella Ramsey very much as Ellie. I don't think she works that well. But it didn't kill it for me. And I honestly didn't expect to like Pedro Pascal as a...
He's so good.
Joel,
he's
but so good. But I was wrong. I think he did a good job. But honestly, if you took out like the last two episodes of the first season, I'd probably be like an 8.5, 8 on it. I really think they like kind of flubbed the ending of the first season, and that's why it kind of got brought down for me.
Yeah. What's about the ending that you don't like?
It just felt rushed. I feel like we didn't get a lot of the character connection between Ellie and Joel that we got in the game, because it wasn't so much that a lot of stuff happened in that ending portion of the game. I think it's just there was a lot of moments where the game kind of forced you to talk to them, to talk to each other and like connect more. And it made that like kind of father daughter relationship feel more earned. And I think the show either didn't want to spend the time doing that, or it didn't understand how important that time with those two characters was. And it just kind of made the ending not hit as hard as it should have.
I think the, I do think it still worked, it's kind of hard for me to come at it from someone who has played the game already, because that was the initial version of the story that I was able to witness and be a part of. But I will say it is weird that the last episode of the entire show is the shortest episode. It was like 42 minutes, and they technically hit all the beats they needed to, you know, with a couple sections thrown out that weren't very story important. But I will say it did feel like there needed to be, like, I don't know, more, just, I wanted more of, like you're saying, I wanted more story, the characters connecting before we get to that ending.
I mean, as someone who didn't play the games, but watched the cutscenes, as I always do for games everybody talks about, but just without that context, I feel like their relationship was like pretty well realized. I didn't have any of those issues. I'm sure if I had the context of like playing as Joel and playing, you play as Ellie too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I was like playing as those two characters, maybe I would feel a different way about the ending, like it wasn't done justice or whatever, but I don't know. I remember specifically feeling like the moment when Ellie sort of saves herself when she gets caught by that weird religious cult, kind of like in that little.
The cannibals.
Yeah, the cannibals. And
yeah, the pedophile.
She sees Joel for the first time after killing that dude, and he's like, "It's okay, baby girl. Like, I got you, baby girl." Like all that stuff. I was like,
"Yeah,
all right." At this point, I see it. Like, I understand why he needs her, why she needs him, like why it's so important. And also relating that back to the note that was written at the end of episode 3, when Nick Offerman's character was like, "That's the reason why men like us are here, to protect others and all that stuff." You know, I don't know. That was all really well done to me, so I don't have those issues about the ending.
Yeah, I
mean, that's good insight as somebody who didn't play the game. I think I just, maybe we took, I took a, I don't know.
Because everyone I've asked that has seen it, who has not played the game, is like, "Oh, it's fucking incredible." So I think it still works. It's just having the perspective we have where we've played the games, it's always going to be compared to that. But I think for general public, this works incredibly well, and it obviously succeeded.
My only issue with the ending is the fact that I think it's very difficult to kind of like transpose that super video gamey end sequence of like Joel
where
having
he's going
to
the hospital.
Yeah, having to fucking like merc he's like a special forces operator, like he's American Sniper going through a hospital and killing like 12 people, despite the fact that they all seem to be military trained too. So it's like, I don't know, that's kind of unbelievable to me. But whatever, you know, that's one of the main difficulties I think they ran into trying to adapt The Last of Us season one game one into a believable story that fits as a viewing experience that makes sense all the way. But I don't know. It's a minor gripe overall.
I don't take issue with that really, because it doesn't work that same way in a video game.
Because it's not Joel is he's competent as a like combatant. You know, they make a point to show you that. So it's not like totally unbelievable. But for me, I was like, is this guy really going to kill like 13 fucking people in a row right now?
I definitely wish they would have had
20. Well.
I definitely wish they had more zombies or fungus creatures in the show. I feel like they did. They kind of skimped out on the first season, but.
Because they only do a handful, and you get like one special zombie, which is the Dwayne the Rock Johnson zombie,
the big boy, the big shroomy
big
boy.
Yeah, I'm curious, what is your problem with Bella Ramsey as Ellie?
First of all, her face is way too small for her head, so it's hard to look at her.
So we're just getting into bullying.
But outside of visual, I think she plays the character more annoying than overconfident. And she's just kind of frustrating. I think Ellie is like, while she's like kind of frustrating in the game, she definitely, you kind of tend to, I don't know, you kind of appreciate her like humor a little bit more. And it's just, when I'm watching the show, I just find Bella Ramsey really annoying. I don't have the same kind of like, I don't know what the word is, but, and it's not endearing. She's not very endearing as a character.
Well, you clearly have a bias because you don't like looking at her face. So,
that's fair. It's kind of hard for me to talk about my critiques of her without getting into spoilers. I don't know. Should we do that yet?
We should just spoil.
Yeah, we're spoiling
spoilers, everybody.
The Last of Us, and then the current season of Last of Us Season 2, which is only episode 1
okay.
at this point of recording.
Okay, so spoilers. So
go yeah. away.
yeah. yeah, I don't have the same issues Nick does with her as like a performer or character. I really like the dynamic between Pedro and Bella. I think they have a lot of chemistry on screen. But that's why I'm so worried about season two, because for me, the biggest selling point of The Last of Us was their relationship, was the adopted daddy-daughter relationship that's very heartwarming, very endearing, like learning to love again at the end of the world. Like, that's what The Last of Us should be to me. But, you know, clearly the creators of this felt much differently by deciding to just kill Joel like immediately at the beginning of game one or game two. So I don't know. I'm concerned mostly about that. I don't know how she carries this series that's so massive without that element, that component, plot component that was so important to the first season. Going into season two without that, that's really concerning for me. You know, that's my main thing.
I think they are trying to pad the car, the incoming car collision that is about to happen, because already in this first episode, he's alive. He's still around. We got him for at least the first episode. He's fine. But I can tell they've already added so much, like so many extra scenes, so many extra layers. Joel's going to fucking therapy sessions in this first episode, which is not at all in the games. We're already getting so much more insight into their story, where as in The Last of Us Part Two game, it kind of starts, you get like one or two scenes with Joel and then he gets fucking clubbed to death. I think he only has a few, like one or two lines, like, and then it's all done in retrospect later in the game. You get all the flashbacks. I think they're trying to front load the season a lot more instead of just dunking the audience into a pool of ice water.
I agree. I don't think Bella Ramsey can carry this show. I think this show at this point, because I know they're going to just kill Joel, it's entirely on Abby's shoulders. And if the chick they have playing Abby doesn't do a good job, the show is over.
I think in that the one scene she's had, she convinced me. I think she's great.
I think she looked pretty good, but I mean,
if it's resting on her shoulders, they're not that big. So comparatively,
it's just a divine, it's a defining character. It's what makes her beating fucking Joel to death with a golf club believable.
Are like, you talking about we're talking muscle still, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not, it probably doesn't matter. I'll be fine because she seems like she's a competent actor. I will say she looks more like Ellie than she does fucking.
I saw people getting mad about that. Yeah.
Than she does Abby. But either way,
I think she's just older. That's why they didn't cast her. Cause she was, I think she's like six or seven. She's 27, 28.
Yeah. But I mean, there was a big time jump anyways. Like,
yeah. I mean, but Bella Ramsey is the exact age. Like she was older when she was playing Ellie in season one. Now she's like a year or two older than her actual character right now. Yeah. She's just very youthful faced.
Yeah.
Something faced.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's just strange. I think I agree with Nick. I mean, just again, being a cutscene watcher, we need a word for cutscene watchers that aren't game players. But I got the impression that one of Abby's defining physical characteristics is the fact that she's like very strong and very bulky. Like, to not cast someone that's sort of in line with that, that represents that as well, is kind of a strange decision to me. Because also, I mean, you know, not to be that guy or whatever, but it's kind of like a body representation issue too. It's like, you don't usually see women like that depicted on screen. It would have been cool to like give us that, you know, or to give that community that too. You guys know what I mean?
I agree. What you're talking about. Yeah, I think the options either you cast someone very buff already, or you do like what a lot of superhero movies do, where you cast someone based on performance and then give them 7 months to get shredded.
Yeah.
Whereas yeah. I think they didn't want to put a strain on her. Maybe they cast her late. I don't know. Because like, if they were just like, no, you got the chops to play this character's performance alone, so it's fine.
But they should have been thinking about this fucking well before season one.
I'm sure they were.
Was even being filmed.
They probably had a lot of discussions about it.
I season one or episode one hasn't given me too much faith. I feel like, I don't know, like, I can't think of that many positives. Like, what did y'all like about the episode?
I liked a lot about the episode, actually. I think the you know, you guys said the therapy angle wasn't in the game, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was really great. That scene with Catherine mm-hmm. O'Hara was excellent. I mean, the acting between those two actors was fucking really, really top notch. I mean, like, Joel just holding back what he wants to say so bad, but he knows, like, you just, even with a therapist, like, if this was, you know, I was thinking about it, it's kind of funny because, like, he probably could say something. Actually, no, you can't say you killed someone to a therapist. You never can. So never mind. But I'm just saying, like, the patient doctor confidentiality thing in the apocalypse, like, I don't know if that really holds. You're paying your therapist yeah. with weed. She's like getting wasted while she's talking to you. So you can't really expect her not to tell people about that. So it's like, of course he can't say it, what he wants to say.
Yeah.
But I love, I love how she calls him out. Like, are we just going to keep pretending like you have the most boring problem in the world? Or you're going to actually like, get down to the brass tacks here? Like, I really love that scene.
Yeah,
I agree. I think the Joel scenes were good, but again, we know probably next episode he's just gone. Yeah. So like, I feel like all the positives are, I don't know. I feel like they're just not going to matter.
Because you guys were like, we in our group chat, we were talking about predictions of when Joel will die this season. And Nick, you said you thought he would die penultimate episode, so like second to last of this season.
Yeah, because I remember you guys telling me or someone telling me that they're splitting the second game into two seasons. So,
they are.
So I would assume like maybe they would give us an entire second season with Joel. But it seems like they're not doing that because... No. Like, obviously, Abby's about to pull up on their whole little community there. I don't know. It seems like he'll probably go at the end of episode two.
Because the whole thing is about Ellie's hunt for Abby and then deciding.
It's a cycle of revenge.
Yeah, it's. So, I mean, they're going to spend a lot of time with that.
Yeah. Yeah,
I hope the Abby actress
is phenomenal. I'm trying to think, like, but there is stuff that has. There has been stuff that happens between the end of season one and the beginning of season two. I mean, I don't know if that's confirmed yet, but at least in the game, after the end of season one or after the end of the first game and the beginning of the second game, a lot of stuff had happened in those 5 years to kind of grow the divide between Ellie and Joel. And I think we're at least going to get some flashbacks. But that's how they did it in the game. As the more you progress, you'll get like periods where you're just flashing back to when Ellie's like 16 and her and Joel are going to a museum and stuff. And I think we are going to get that, but I don't, I don't think it's going to be, I think they're probably just going to do it in the same way, just basing that off of how we've already seen the structure of the season that is very much mirroring the second game pretty closely.
Yeah. And I will say it's a bold story decision to kill Joel. Like, it's bold.
Yes.
I think it totally makes sense. And if the theme of the second game and these two next seasons is going to be like the ramifications of violence and the vicious cycle that creates, like, of course that makes sense. It makes sense to have there be very lasting and brutal consequences for him doing what he does at the end of season two or the end of season one. But I'm just saying, like, I don't know what that does for the overall watchability of the story and just the radical change it will create from what season one was supposed to be about, which was, I mean, Joel is the main character of season one, you know, right? Like, and game one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and just to change that, to change the dynamic between that, you know, that adopted daddy-daughter thing that so many people latched onto about this game and this show, to just nix that right at the beginning of season two, like, it's bold, but I just don't think it really works ultimately, you know?
Yeah, I didn't really like the second game all that much. I think gameplay wise it was really great, but I never really got that connection to Abby as a character to like kind of like, I feel like a lot of people kind of were like, what the fuck, and then they like started being like, Abby's kind of sick. I don't feel like I really got that during the game. And maybe I just, I don't know, maybe it just wasn't my thing. But I really liked the first game way more than I liked the second game. So even just going in on like a storyline level based on the games, I'm not super confident.
You get to play as Abby, right?
Yeah. Yes.
It's like 50-50 split between her and Ellie.
It's you. So the story of two is like a split narrative where you play as Ellie's revenge cycle in Washington trying to find Abby. And then once they finally meet up, it switches back all the way back into the day that Joel sieged the hospital and killed everybody. And then we basically play from there and follow her days, like basically with Ellie acting as like this ghost that's like haunting her and her friends. And then you have a confrontation, and then there's like an epilogue that's like 10 hours long after that. So it makes sense that they're splitting it. I just am curious where they're going to end the season, because I expect this season will end on a cliffhanger and it's going to make people mad.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to. 7 episodes is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, the first scene that you get with Abby and her whole crew, I thought was really, really excellent. Like, I thought, mm-hmm. because it's just crazy. Like, if we were to just start, if Last of Us started with that, you know, like, you would totally, totally empathize with those characters with no reservations. You would be like, yeah, let's fucking kill this Joel guy. He's a fucking prick.
Yeah, I think they do a better job of it in the show than they even did in the game, as far as, like, kind of setting up Abby as, like, a character you can kind of relate to and understand.
Yeah,
because she shows up as like fucking out of nowhere. Yeah. like just shows up, boom, and then you're like, I think that was one of the issues with the narrative in the actual game, was she shows up, does this horrible thing in this incredibly gruesome, painful way to a character you love, and then you're told by the game director, like, listen, now you're going to empathize with her, you're going to learn about her backstory, and you're going to like it. And it's like, I think that's really hard to get someone on board for that after what they have done, which is why so many people checked out of this game. You know, that's why the second one is so controversial.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
so I'm glad they're setting her up beforehand.
It's like I said, it's a really bold choice. I feel like there's a way it can work, but it's just like, there are very few examples of just, you know, stories, not game, any medium, you know, it's just like, radically changing the focus of the narrative and just like the themes so much from the first part to the second part where it actually works. I can't even really think of an example besides this where it actually even happens. You know, it's like it's very rare that stuff that you'll just kill the main character and be like, oh yeah, he actually wasn't the main character. You know, like,
yeah.
Well, I think about how much better the game would have gone over if, like, maybe they, like, started you off as Abby hunting somebody you don't know who it is, but you understand, like, what that character did to them, and then you find out it's Joel, and then you kill Joel, and you're like, oh, fuck, I don't know how to feel about this, as opposed to, I feel bad about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought when I had played the first and second Last of Us games, and there was all this controversy, I kind of imagined that in a different world, it would have been cool to have like the second Last of Us. They kind of just lie to our faces and go like, listen, this is an anthology series. Each game is going to be new characters in a new world. And we just pick up and play as Abby, and you kind of get a similar story to what she goes through. And then by the end, it's like revealed like, oh shit, I've connected to this character. And I found out, oh man, Joel basically murdered everyone she's ever loved. And then the third game would be the confrontation section. I feel like that would at least be a little bit more conflicting for a main story where you like have spent an equal amount of time with both of these characters and you fully understand where they're coming from. And then you just kind of have to deal with the bloodbath.
Yeah.
Yeah. It felt like it was like very intentional to piss people off. And then whenever you get pissed, like, I hate when companies are like, whenever you get pissed off about something that's like pretty understandable and they're like, you just hate it because it's a woman. It's just like, what are you fucking talking about? You just killed the fucking main character that I've probably beat this game 4 times since this game came out. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I don't hate it because it's a woman. I hate it because the way you crafted this story is really fucking like shocking and in a bad way.
Yeah. Oh, I, cause just before I said, I can't think of any instances where this, something like this happens from part one to part two. The big one would be Game of Thrones, but the big difference between Game of Thrones and have you guys seen that?
Of course.
Ethan?
Yeah, okay. I've seen it, okay. Unfortunately.
Okay, so, yeah, I didn't want to do a big spoiler or whatever. But no, everyone knows Ned. Everybody fucking knows Ned Stark dies. That's not a spoiler, right? I'm scarred from spoiler
watching. Oh, shit.
What? I didn't when I watched the show.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's awesome. Now that Game of Thrones has been out for so long, I'm just saying. But anyway, you know, Ned Stark dies, but the difference between Game of Thrones and The Last of Us is there's so many other characters that you have that they've basically treated as sort of the main character before Ned's death. So it's like, okay, Ned's gone. I did not expect that to happen, but now I have Jon Snow and Arya and Daenerys and all these people that you can connect to. But this game, it's just like, so we got this new girl, Abby, and we have Ellie. And it's just like, is that enough? Have we developed a bond as protagonists, you know, as viewer to protagonists with these characters enough to just like act Joel right away? I don't know.
I think you do. I think they're trying to do that, do more for the show. Like there's more emphasis on Tommy and Maria. And I feel like the town itself is getting more of like characterization than it did have in the actual game. So I think they are trying to build out the world itself to not feel like it's basically a backdrop for Joel and Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
The guy they have playing Tommy is a goddamn horrible actor.
I think he's great. I didn't think so. I like him. I don't know what you're talking about.
He sucks, bro. All of his lines sound so unnatural. He sounds... Ugh.
I think
it
I
doesn't
like
even
him.
Feel like
he's
an
got a good
HBO
mustache.
Show.
So yeah, you were asking Nick earlier what I did like about it. There were certain things that I did like. I thought my initial reaction to seeing the whole like dance sequence and everything, like, and then when Ellie gets mad at Joel, I was initially like, this is fucking stupid. Like, why are you getting so mad at this guy for just defending you after this like homophobic prick just embarrassed you in front of everybody? But then I remembered, it's like, you're supposed to be thinking that like Ellie is starting to realize that Joel lied to her about what happened with the Firefly. She doesn't know exactly what happened, but she's starting to be like, I think he did some fucked up shit to get me out of there. And yeah. Joel doing that to that homophobic dude is like, that's exactly what she is mad at him for doing in the first place. That's the big dividing line. You were defending me when I didn't ask to be defended, you know? So it's like, I was like, oh, that's actually really good. You know, it kind of made me think
about
it.
But at the same time, Ellie's like the biggest fucking hothead in the world. Like, I don't believe that she would get mad about something like that. Because it's exactly what she would do. It's exactly what she was about to do.
They don't tell people. Oh, I know, but she wanted to do it herself.
Yeah, yeah.
but, like, I don't know if they're going to do this in the same game. Or match it in the same way that the second game did. But in between the first and second games, Ellie goes to the Firefly base and finds out like exactly what happened. Like she reads old reports and like recordings and stuff. And then they kind of have this whole, you know, she kind of blows up on him and is like, I don't want anything to do with you. So I don't know if the show's going to do that as well, but if that is the same thing, then that it makes it way more justified.
Oh, so she knows, understandable. She knows for sure.
In the game,
she might, yeah. if they follow the same thing as the game, then she already knows at this point.
And Joel knows that she knows by the time that dance happens.
Joel knows that she knows, yeah. But he just won't tell anyone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that makes sense. That's good. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just like it's a character choice. I'm not sure what Ellie's necessarily like in the games, but I feel like her and Dina being that cocky and like disrespecting the authority of, you know, this small community that they're building is fucked up. But, you know, it's like, you know, some people are like that. Some people are just really cocky and they don't really give a shit about. I think I watched the after the episode or, you know, the segment that they do inside the episode or whatever. And the Dina actor was like, it's not like we are disrespecting the authority. It's like, give us a reason to observe your authority for us to like actually think that you're somebody that we should listen to, that we should be governed by mostly, you know? So it's like, I understand that, but it's kind of difficult to watch these two young people who are just like, they seem to be totally disregarding the structure of like the, you know, municipal structure of this like little town that they're building. Like that's kind of fucked up. I don't necessarily appreciate that. You know, like there's a chain of command. You should observe it. That's my thing. But
yeah, that part did get a little frustrating for me. Cause I was just like, can you guys stop fucking around? There are literally two clickers and a goddamn stalker zombie in the other room. And you guys are fucking joking around.
Yeah.
The only reason Ellie's allowed to be there is because of Joel too. It's like,
she's a Nepo baby, dude.
She's a Nepo because everyone's scared Joel's going to kill them.
Is that Joel's reputation of being like a psycho, basically?
I mean, no, I don't think so. I think they just think in the community, they know that Joel's kind of scary. That's all they know. He's like a very scary, grumpy man. Yeah. I mean, Tommy knows he's like a murderer.
Is Joel Trump, dude? He's like, we can't take these refugees. They're gonna ruin our country. You know. And then the other person was like, Joel, you were a refugee too once, and he was like, wrong.
Yeah, and it was also nice to see Joel get to be like cute. You know, I like him like interacting with his nephew, which is, I don't remember this. Nick, does Tommy and Maria, like, do they have a kid in the game? Because I do not remember them having a fucking kid.
I don't remember it either.
Okay, because I like this addition of just like there's like a family, and it's cute to see Joel, like, I don't know, interact with the kid, and it's cringe, but you don't get to see him be like a regular old dude. And it's nice What's to crazy, have this before everything happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every character I like more than Ellie. Like, her friend, I like more than Ellie. Abby, I like more than Ellie. Like, in the whole show, like, everybody outshines Ellie for me. And it just, yeah, like, I don't know, man.
Is there...
It's not just because she's ugly.
Is there a massive difference between the characterization of Ellie in the show and the game?
I wouldn't say it's really that massive. I'd say I think it's just different flavors.
Yeah, I'd say the characterization is the same. I think it's just how it's played is a little bit off for me.
I do disagree with you. I think Bella Ramsey is a good performer. I do. I worry about her capability to not just her to capability. Not her capability as like an actor to hold her own in that way, but I think it's more of just her character. Like I just don't necessarily see it.
She's too soft, man. Like
I don't know that about
scene that. Where she's like don't pull punches. Like I just don't fucking buy it, bro. Like
really?
Oh, come on, man.
I think she's super. I totally buy that she's like a scrappy like fighter, and I don't know. I totally bought that. I never thought it was like phony.
I can't get behind.
They're also showing she's overly cocky as well. Like sure she can hold her own, but also they're like, yeah, we're not really fighting you actually.
Yeah,
but it's not so much how strong she is; it's just her the way. Like whenever she's trying to be tough, I just don't buy it.
I thought just something you didn't think that scene, that fight scene, was well done. I mean, I thought it showed you in like as realistic a way as you possibly could, a way for somebody like a little 19-year-old girl of her size, if she is gonna take down a dude that's like 6'4" and like yoked like that guy
I'm
was
talking
like
about the real I'm not talking about how realistic the fight is. I'm just talking about like her dialogue during it. Like I can't buy her as like a hard ass.
Yeah I don't know, but overall another thing that I thought was cool is how they're making the cordyceps potentially intelligent. Like that was pretty that's a pretty interesting angle.
In the second game, they introduce a bunch of new like zombie types, basically. Because in the first game, it was just standard infected, clickers, and then bloaters, which was like that gigantic one in the first season. And then I don't remember. I think there's like two or three new ones they add. They add the stalkers. They add ones that like basically cement themselves into walls. And then they add the Rat King. I don't want to spoil what that is.
But I know about
that
him.
Probably won't be a thing till season 3. I'm guessing that'll be a season 3 thing since that's an Abby portion. But that's gonna be fuck. I hope that looks fucking awesome when we see that. But yeah, they're getting smarter. That was a very well executed scene, and I think it was just very eerie. Like I love the just the shots of it crawling around in the background.
Yeah, it was like Hereditary. Sorry, Nick.
Yeah,
I think the scene whenever they're. And going into the building was good. I think Abby's scene was good. And I think all the Joel stuff was good. But it's not enough to make me confident going forward.
Yeah. I will say, is The Last of Us the most disgusting portrayal of zombies we've ever had? Like, are The Last of Us zombies the grossest?
I mean, if we're being specific on what a zombie is... If it's like any kind of viral
infection, they're zombies, bro. These are fucking... You can call them infected. No.
I'm calling them zombies, but like there are other things that I've heard I think it's a movie from Asia or somewhere in Asia where it's the infection basically removes the part of your brain that is like moral and it just makes you like commit the most heinous acts possible. Like, they're just like, you turn into a guy that's like, all right, we're going to cover this baseball in barbed wire and go hit a guy in the crotch. Like, that's what the movie turns into.
I think it depends on your, I think it depends on your idea of gross, because if you think about like traditional zombies, and like, we have a level of separation through the screen, but it's rotting flesh. Like, real normal zombies are fucking disgusting. And imagine like an actual like old decrepit zombie is like walking up to you, and how bad that shit would smell, and how horrible it would be for one of those to like to bite you.
Yeah.
I just like to imagine you sitting there, like, with a zombie coming towards you, and you're just like, oh my God.
I don't know how I don't find fungus to be necessarily as gross as like rotting human flesh.
I don't know. I think it's there's portions. I think it was in season one where you see like close ups of the vines coming out of their fingernails, and it's just a really viscerally disgusting.
It's definitely more unnerving visually.
It gets like, and then you look at Ellie's bite, which is healed, but it's scarred, and there's still the fucking cordyceps is just like in there. It's just like petrified or whatever.
Yeah,
it's very gross.
I am personally like disgusted by certain types of fungi, like when you see the clickers, like when their faces have like turned into mushrooms, basically
a
like
split mushroom.
Yeah,
head.
I really, really hate that, because I mean, it's not rotting flesh, but it's like cancer. There's like a certain kind of like morphed, disgusting, cancerous look to it that is very
gross.
Yeah,
because it's like whatever part deteriorates on their body is replaced with mushrooms.
Yeah.
It's so disgusting. It's a really genius concept for zombies.
Yeah.
No, I love it. I think it works really well.
All right. Well, yeah. I feel like we've covered this enough.
Yeah.
We'll loop back into...
I don't want to give it a rating, but I'll give it a good thumbs up. I'm optimistic.
Overall, if we're just doing thumbs up or thumbs down, not like a rating, I'll do a thumbs up overall.
If I had to do up or down, I would do down. But it's like more in the middle for me. Like, because I just don't know yet.
All right. So the last thing we want to talk about is YouTube content creator iDubbbz. Because I have a personal history with watching iDubbbz content. I was a pretty big fan of his work in like the mid 2000s when he was doing the Content Cop series.
Bad unboxing.
I actually only really watched the Content Cops. I wasn't like a major fan of him globally. I just love that he was taking down channels like Keemstar and Leafy, because I hated them so much. Like, I thought Leafy was the laziest, most like mean-spirited channel YouTube. And I was so glad. I mean, the way that iDubbbz takes him down is also equally mean-spirited, and he was kind of a mean-spirited guy back then. But like, I appreciated someone taking him down a peg, you know. But we're bringing it up today because he's bringing back Content Cop. So I wanted to see what you guys thought about that.
Well, I watched all of his content. I watched the bad unboxing shit. I watched his crossover shit with Filthy Frank and all that stuff. So I was a really big fan of iDubbbz. So, I don't know. Do we want to talk about his downfall at all before his come
yeah,
up, his
comeback? Nick, you made a whole video about this. I haven't seen it, but I saw you had a video about the fall of iDubbbz how he views his fans.
I even take issue with like the downfall of iDubbbz. I don't think that's like a fair way to really characterize it. I think, you know, if we're just going to talk about how many views he was getting back then to how many views he's getting now, like, sure, it's a downfall. But I don't think it's like, I don't think he did anything necessarily wrong to earn a downfall like other content creators have.
But no, I think that's not really fair, because if you look at his downvote ratio, if you look at the actual comments in his videos, like, people fucking hate this guy now.
Yeah,
that is a downfall.
It's a downfall in terms of people, not his old fans, not necessarily liking a lot of the stuff he said, but. I don't really take issue with most of it. I totally understand where he's coming from, you know.
But I understand that. But I don't think a downfall necessarily has to be something that he did necessarily right or wrong. But it is a downfall in terms of his success, popularity, and like how people view him as a content creator.
Yeah, no, I'll agree with that there. I think like the way the connotation of downfall for me is like those videos you see of, I don't know, what was that guy? Boogie 298 or whatever, his downfall. Yeah. Because he did like some horrible shit, or I don't even know his story. But we'll move past that. It's whatever. that's just a little bugaboo or whatever that I've had with a lot of those videos.
I agree with you. I don't think that what he did is necessarily wrong. I think the way he went about it was very short-sighted and alienating for a lot of people when it really didn't need to be that way. And I think that's his biggest problem. I think he didn't actually take into account that all of these people that he's like shit-talking and like lumping in together aren't necessarily these like horrible people that he pictures them as. And like I was a big fan of iDubbbz. I don't think I'm a massive racist person that only watched his videos because he said the N-word, you know?
Yeah.
But whenever you call like people who watch your videos like basement dwellers and saying you're making videos catered to them, you're alienating people you don't have to. You could have just said, hey, the content I made, I don't necessarily feel that way anymore. I don't think that that's a good representation of who I am. And I'm just going to have a little bit different content moving forward. Saying something as simple as that would have basically negated all of this.
Yeah. Do you guys mind if I like contextualize? I just want to give like a brief rundown because I don't know if Ethan knows everything that, you know, all the context.
Give me a rundown. So I need a refresher.
So basically, like as Nick's referring to, like a lot of iDubbbz content in the mid 2000s, like the Content Cop, I don't really know about Bad Unboxing, Kickstarter Crab that much. But a lot of it and his entire aesthetic on YouTube was like very, very edgy, you know, bordering on extremely racist. Like he called his community N-word F-words, you know? So it's like, that's pretty fucked up and definitely doesn't sound very good with like 2025 goggles on, you know, like
yeah. It's
pretty fucked up. And he had a couple really viral moments of him like saying the N-word publicly. So it's like, yeah, it's pretty bad looking back on it now, like pretty objectively bad.
I've seen the clip. I don't know who it was. He went up to and met with some woman and like while they were posing for.
Yeah,
for,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know who that is anymore. And said it with
she's
her.
Still pretty popular, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. She is like seems even more popular now than she was then. But anyway, so yeah, that's how he was back then. And then slowly over the next 10 years, you know, like about 2015 to now, he really backed away from that kind of content. He started making other sorts of content. But what really I don't think people really took issue with that. It's really more of what Nick's talking about. It's like the way he was kind of talking about not only his own content that he made back then and really distancing himself from it, but distancing himself from his old fans as well. And being like, the main clip that I saw about, he was talking about it with one of the dudes from Smosh. He did like a podcast with him and he was like, it was getting to the point where anytime I would be at like a convention or a YouTuber convention where you can meet your fans, all of the people who were coming up to me were these like basement dwelling weirdos who were like saying the N-word in front of me and Ian trying to be like, that's not cool, like don't do that in public. And he did not really like the community that he was garnering, that he had built with his content. So what he did was he put up a video, I think like a year or two ago, called like I Miss the Old iDubbbz, where he apologized for a lot of the stuff I talked about, you know, like racial comments and slurs and stuff like that, and also kind of was distancing himself more from the old content and his fans. So that's, and now he seems to be overtly taking a left-wing stance and making content against Trump and Musk and a lot of like conservative ideology that's going on online now. So that's kind of where we're at. I just wanted to like
also groundwork. Further context, he also he has his girlfriend Anissa too, who is very much a shit starter. Like she's constantly just saying things to piss people off. There was also this big thing where she started an OnlyFans while they're like basically married, and he's just like, I'm cool with it, and everybody was calling him a cuck a bunch too. That was a big part of the controversy. It was kind of around the same time. So I mean, this is it's a combination of things.
Yeah,
I don't understand what, so people were mad about, like,
people were mad that he was basically saying my old content, I don't like
well,
it
anymore. I understand that part. I mean, another the wife thing. I'm like, him and his wife agreed.
It was all lumped into the same thing of people having this image of him, this new image of him, basically saying, I hate all my old content, I don't like my old fans, my wife does OnlyFans, I'm okay with it. It was just a combination of things where people had so much ammo against him to just shit talk him that it was like there was nothing he could do about it at that point.
Yeah, I mean, the comment I sent you guys is really funny and kind of encapsulates this whole thing where it was like, iDubbbz is the only person in the history of the internet to get canceled for not being racist anymore. He's like, he has to do post apology videos about being less racist and like less, you know, edgy.
I'm sorry, I don't say the N-word anymore.
Yeah, that's but that's literally what it is. It's so funny. In terms of like the OnlyFans thing, yeah, people were just, they had an impression of who he was based on how edgy he was in his videos. But it's like, I watched an interview he did with his wife and Ethan Klein on the H3 podcast, and they were both saying like, you know, he might have appeared that way in his videos, but his content was always like highly performative. He's not showing everybody everything about himself. He wasn't really like this ultra like Sam Hyde type of character. He was more left leaning the entire time. It was just that eventually, I think, as it's not just like he changed, but also culture changed, like YouTube changed. There's like, you know, things started to get, people started to be less accepting of that kind of humor, that brand that he was building. So he was like, you know, that's not really what I'm like anymore. And I think that's fine.
The Sam Hyde video also didn't help him very much. Did you watch all those?
I did. I did. Yeah.
What's the like, Sam Hyde video?
So I don't know who basically Sam Hyde is. He's a fairly, he's a very controversial comedian.
Oh boy.
Possibly, I mean,
Nazi.
He's tied to a bunch of
things. Seems like he's
shit,
a Nazi.
Yeah. But anyway,
oh, I have seen this guy. Yeah.
So basically, iDubbbz went to go do like he does these little documentaries where he did one about Airsoft Fatty, he did one about Dax Flame, and then he did one about Sam Hyde. But he went to go make one about Sam Hyde, and it seemed like it was meant to be kind of like a hit piece against Sam Hyde because he wanted him to kind of admit that he is actually racist because he doesn't understand whether or not the things Sam Hyde says are like meant to be satirical or not, because Sam Hyde is very much like, he doesn't really give his direct political views because you never really understand if he's joking or not. Mm-hmm. And it seems like Sam Hyde, I felt like he took a really long time to release his version of the documentary because I think he didn't really know how to edit it in a way that made him come off in a good light. So Sam Hyde basically was like, I'm releasing a version of the documentary with our footage because iDubbbz is taking forever. And it kind of showed that iDubbbz kind of did get really duped by Sam Hyde, and it seemed like iDubbbz didn't take it very well.
But he did eventually release it. I mean, he edited
it. He did eventually release
it. And it did really well. You know, that's one of the best performing videos on his channel. So
yeah. No, I think he did a good job. I definitely think he had one pulled over on him, and it did seem like he wasn't very happy about it.
Yeah. I mean, overall, the thing for me with iDubbbz is it's just like, I think he's a really, really interesting case study to look at how an individual's perception of themselves can be radically changed. And it basically, iDubbbz transformation reflects almost one-to-one with how everything else in the world changed culturally from 2015 to 2025. Like, he was super edgy in 2015. So is YouTube. But then in 2025, YouTube isn't really like that anymore, and neither is he. I'm not saying that that's exactly why. Like, he just allowed the fact that the adpocalypse like changed the way things were run on YouTube, and you couldn't really say the stuff like that anymore on YouTube. I mean, I'm sure that was probably part of it. Probably a little bit of it was like a financial concern he had. Or he's like, maybe I should clean things up a little bit. I don't know. But I just find it very interesting to consider where he's at right now. I think it's also super interesting that he's bringing back Content Cop. I'm sure he's going to be focusing it on more like Steven Crowder type channels, you know, at this point, since if you look at the last five videos he's made, it's all like kind of dismantling conservative arguments and stuff, the same way he used to dismantle shitty content creators. So it's kind of like the same sort of content, just a different target.
He's just shifting the target. Yeah.
Yeah. And I honestly welcome it. I think he's doing right now what he should have done in the first place, which is just make content that's good and works in modern times. I just think he spent so much time alienating people whenever all he needed to do was change his content and say nothing.
But that's what he was doing. That he did that for a couple of years.
But his content wasn't good.
I mean, I don't know.
That's the difference.
It was
the quality different of that video you linked the other day was obscenely higher than anything he released in that period where he was falling off.
Yeah,
he was posting squirrel watching videos and shit like that. Like,
yeah, he like built his own pimple popping toy. I actually like that video. Did you watch that one?
I watched a lot of his videos, his videos were good. They were like, I think they leaned into the edge. I think he has grown as a content creator since then, like recently. But I don't think I think he had like a big crutch before where he could just be edgy and people would think it's funny. And I think he had to learn how to actually make good content.
Yeah. I find it really interesting to look at that shift that he was making. It's like, how do I still make content without doing the content cop shit? Like, it took him a while to figure that out, which is totally reasonable. You know, like he had to change. He wanted to. I don't know if he had to. He had to change everything about the way he was doing shit on YouTube. And it took him a while to get there, and he alienated people. I think the thing that alienated people the most was like the whole thing with his wife and the OnlyFans thing, which is pretty fucking dumb in my opinion. Like, I don't know. Why is that going to make you not watch somebody because their wife has an OnlyFans? Like, I don't know. Why is it your business?
Yeah,
there's also a big push against that. I mean, that was like a big dispute, like 2019 and shit like that. Like people,
But I just don't understand the getting. It's like that meme where it's like, I consent, and then they're like, is there someone you forgot to ask? And it's like random fucking people on the internet. It's like, I don't know, if they're in a fucking consenting relationship, then they're both.
That's
cool
just part of being a content creator, though. Like you do, you're going to be judged for.
Well, it's part.
I'm not saying that's right or wrong.
It's part of being a content creator like him, because his content created this perception of him in his fans' minds that ended up not really being what he was actually like. Like, clearly, yeah. if so, say like ContraPoints or some other like breadtuber had a partner that had an OnlyFans, like everyone online, all of their fans would be like, oh, that's fine. I don't really fucking give a shit. But since it's iDubbbz, since he built his brand off like being kind of an asshole, like people are not going to be okay with that, you know? So that's also interesting to me too. But I mean, I don't know. How do you guys feel like this whole content cop thing is going to go? Because I was reading the comments on the video where he posted that he was going to bring back content cop, and it was like very, very mixed. And like people were like, I'm kind of excited, but I'm also extremely worried.
I think a lot of the people that hate him have already stopped watching him for the most part. So I think
he has a
good chance of like creating a new following as long as the content is good.
Cause when was the last time he uploaded one of his like super edgy videos? Like what, 6 years ago?
Probably
7 years ago?
More closer
so
to
10. So they're gone.
Yeah.
They're gone.
Yeah. I think there's still always going to be people in his his comments that are like, I miss the old iDubbbz unironically, you know? And they're going to see him like trying to take down, I don't know. Like, I don't want to say, because I watched Content Cop in 2015 and I'm the furthest thing from a Trump supporter. So it's like, I don't know if all of those people are going to be mad that he's talking, that his targets are now like conservative YouTube channels and politicians.
I don't
and
think
stuff.
His main audience was conservatives. I don't even think his content was racial or like was politically charged in any way.
It was just like edgy shit.
Like, yeah, like whenever we were kids at that time, it was just like, it's bad to say, but like people were just shouting the fucking N-word on Call of Duty.
They still are if you play Call of Duty.
Well, I'm just saying, like, that's just kind of how things were. Like, I mean, it's not okay, but that's how it was.
No, it really was. I mean, it was different in 2005 when we were kids than it was in 2015. I wouldn't have been fucking shouting the N-word in 2015. I found it like pretty shocking that that was what he called his community was N-word F-words. You know, like that was kind of crazy to me at the time even. But I don't know, because I think...
Which N-word?
The N-word.
You know.
The one I use or the other one?
Dude, you gotta stop.
Yeah,
you get into these snafus.
This is an inside joke.
You're putting yourself.
I'm not racist. I swear,
Ethan. He's referring to we weren't
N-A-Z-I.
Yeah, we weren't sure if we could use
double
Nazi.
Ethan's taking my spot as the racist one.
No.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's basically the iDubbbz controversy.
I'm hopeful. I hope it works, because I don't hate him. I think that he's made some poor decisions, but I don't hate the guy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Personally, like my video, the video that I made about him, it didn't really take issue with him kind of retroactively saying, I don't really stand behind that stuff. And I've also grown as a person. I really identified with that because I was like, yeah, if there was a camera on me when I was 22 and I was saying whatever the fuck came to my head constantly and, you know, taking down channels and stuff and doing these takedown videos, I would probably have a lot of content online that I'm not super psyched about watching when I'm in my early 30s. You know, that's totally fair. And I feel fine about that. My issue was he had this whole thing where he was like, back then I had this whole idea in my head that I wasn't responsible for my audience. Like he felt like the way his community and the things he said had a ripple effect throughout his community, blah, blah, blah. And he had to take more ownership about the way his audience behaved on like other parts of the internet, which personally I think is like kind of bullshit. It's sort of like it's like covertly egotistical, yeah, to be like, I have all of these people are listening to what I say. I'm effectively like a thought leader who like gives people cues and they therefore like go out and act in bad ways all over the internet. Like, I think that's kind of bullshit and it's not just him who says that, but I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I think there are people who sort of weaponize their audience. Like, I think like absolutely, people like Andrew Tate probably be somebody who kind of weaponizes their audience, but I don't think his content was anywhere like that. And I think it's kind of, like you said, egotistical to think that way.
I think there is some inherent responsibility to at least deter those people from doing that, because if you're garnering an audience that is actively seeking out people to harass and target, or hopefully not SWAT, but that happens as well, you need to make a statement about that. And a lot of these people kind of use that as a like, hey, I didn't tell him to do that. I just made fun of this person relentlessly. And, you know, and knowing my fan base has had a history of doing this, I just didn't say anything. I think for certain people, it can become like very morally questionable.
That was the main caveat I had, because it's like, yeah, iDubbbz Content Cop series, he would go after Leafy and Keemstar and like whoever that fucking, I don't know, all the other people that he went after, like he would go after them hard. And it's like, if he feels some sense of responsibility to his fan base, then going out and doing fucked up things and doxing and cyberbullying Leafy or his community, like, yeah, I get that. I totally understand that. But just like blanket responsibility for your audience, I mean, there was like 7,000 or 7 million people in his audience at that time. It's like, you don't have that much control over them, bro. Like, I don't know. I just didn't really see how that made sense. But,
well, also in that, that Sam Hyde documentary, he's like, I think he's on quote saying, I'm not used to not being the, what did he say? Like, I'm used to being the puppet master. I think that was what he said.
Hmm.
It's like, he didn't like that he wasn't in control of how things were going. And it's just like, I think he does come off as having a very big ego a lot of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's hard to be that with Sam Hyde, because like we were saying, you never know when he's serious, when something is a joke, when he means something. And that was my favorite part of the video that iDubbbz did about him, when he was talking about like the post irony flow chart, where it's like, I don't remember how it is. Meta irony, or that whole thing. Which I do genuinely think Sam Hyde is like a malignant influence on the internet, because he says these things that Nazis say, but he's like, he can always step away from it and be like, oh, well, I don't actually mean it. I was kidding, you know? But it's like,
I think there need to be people like that, though. I think without people like pushing the button too far, like people like, because you have people like him that are way too far on one side, and you have people that are way too far on the opposite side. Then you have like somebody like Shane Gillis popping up that kind of takes – Shane Gillis obviously took influence from Sam Hyde. Like, there's no doubt about it. He 100% – no, he's been on Sam Hyde's podcast. He's like 100% a lot of his humor was derived from Sam Hyde's early stuff, because I watched a lot of Sam Hyde's like early iPhone videos and stuff whenever I was younger. And I think that he was a very, very big influence in his type of humor. But I think that there have to be people way too far on both sides so people can, like, I don't know, learn what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, but I mean, We're gonna get into a political thing. Sorry, but
we can make it a political.
It's hard. It's just hard to be like, yeah, we can have one person who's too far on the other side, and one person that's too far on the other side. But it's like, if you're hinting at, which he's gone farther than hinting at, like Nazi viewpoints. That, like, the Nazi viewpoint is saying explicitly that I want certain groups of people to either die or not be in this country anymore, and they can be forcibly removed. Whereas people on the left, most you're going to hear them saying is we should dismantle capitalism, you know, which that doesn't necessarily, there doesn't need to be violence for that to happen, you know. And I just think it's like,
I don't
think
that Sam Hyde necessarily does. It's hard. It's hard to hint at those things as a joke, but. It's edgy humor. It's like, I don't know.
I think
people make jokes about people like murdering, like leftists make jokes about like murdering the president and shit all the time. Like we should fucking storm the Capitol and fucking kill everybody. Like that's a leftist joke all the time. Like there's the Time for Guillotine song with Trevor Moore where he's talking about taking all of the political leaders and beheading them all.
Yeah, I mean, I also think there's a difference between talking about that, talking about the powerful in that way, and then talking about just like your average citizen in that way.
A minority group.
It's way different. The context is different. I mean, it's punching up and punching down, which, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I guess so.
But regardless of Sam Hyde or anything or like that, I mean, I don't know. iDubbbz made that documentary. I thought it was really interesting. I think I also watched Sam Hyde's version too. And I kind of just like don't really understand why those two guys don't like each other. I don't think iDubbbz's documentary ended up being like a hit piece on Sam Hyde at all.
No.
So I don't understand why he's so
pissed.
I think
that's because Sam didn't let him though.
Mm. Like his initial plans for it were much different.
It really felt that way to me, but I mean, honestly, I would wonder what Ethan would think if he went through and watched it, not knowing either of them very well.
Yeah. Well,
but
you guys want to,
I don't know.
Maybe we should wrap it up here. I think we've said enough.
She said. Yeah, I think we can wrap it up. All right. Well, we're not going to be doing
What's your pick? Oh, wait,
We're not going to be doing the normal rec because next episode we have a guest. We have Jack, who runs a few channels. He runs the Riatham. He'll chew me out if I get that wrong. Riatham Beats YouTube channel where he makes his own music. And he's also the channel head guy at Sardonicast Highlights. So he runs in that circle. So we're going to be having him as our guest. And he has recommended that we talk about the 2005 rom-com Hitch.
Oh, nice.
I love that.
So we'll be talking about Hitch next episode. So if you do not want to be spoiled, make sure to watch it before next episode. If you're listening to this on YouTube, please leave us a like and a comment. Let us know what you think. If you have any questions as well. If you're listening to this on one of our audio-only platforms like Apple Podcasts, and I guess Spotify isn't an exclusively audio-only platform anymore. They have that new video feature. Leave us a review on either of those because those also help out a ton in the algorithm.
Send us to your friends,
send us to your grandmothers. We're really good with grandmas. And get Stuckmanized, everybody.
Wait, can we say get Oppenheimed?
Get Oppenheimized. Get Oppenheimer Gangnam style.
Sloppenheimer.
All right, see you guys.
Good night, everybody.
Bye. Good night, everybody.